how Democrats talk about immigration today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Immigration has been a big topic at both conventions. Last night, the Democrats invited 11-year-old Carla Ortiz to take the stage.
My parents came here looking for a better life, for the American dream, el sueño americano.
Our reporter who's been to both conventions tells us more, also what it means when someone from the U.S.-Mexico border says this.
My family never crossed a border. The border crossed us.
We'll hear what a border historian makes of that, plus how the First Lady's convention speech went down in Lagos, Nigeria.
Yeah, everybody's unanimous. It's Michelle Obama for president.
Those stories and more today here on The World. The Democratic National Convention is underway in Philadelphia. Last night, the speakers included Democrat heavy hitters like Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Michelle Obama. But it was 11-year-old Carla Ortiz who caught our attention.
Soy Americana. I was born in Las Vegas, Nevada. My parents came here looking for a better life, for the American dream. El sueño americano.
Carla Ortiz spoke about her fears that her parents, both undocumented, could be deported. But she said, Hillary will do the worrying for me and for all of us. The World's Maria Muriel is in Philadelphia covering the DNC.
So it seemed like throughout the night, lots of speakers were sort of playing up their immigrant backgrounds, but not just in the way that people usually talk about immigrants, which is, you know, immigrants are Latino. Immigrants come from the south of the border. Immigrants speak a different language. We had Boston's Irish-American mayor, Marty Walsh, on stage talking about his immigrant roots.
I followed my father into the building trades when I was 18 years old. Labor gave my immigrant family a chance, and the labor community got me the help I needed and gave me a second chance.
Yeah, Mayor Marty Walsh from Boston reminding us that most Americans were immigrants at one point, not just the recent ones. You kind of alluded to this earlier. Did it start to feel like a lot of people were trying hard to show off their immigrant bona fides?
It did a little. I sort of facetiously made a comment like, wow, it seems like a lot of people are, you know, children of immigrants here. But, you know, it's totally valid. Like you said, a lot of us, most of us are either immigrants or descendants from immigrants.
Yeah, stakes are far higher for some immigrants than for others, though. So on the face of things, immigration reform seems to be a big part of Hillary Clinton's and the Democrats' agenda. As you say, immigrant stories kicked off the convention yesterday. But you've been seeing a debate unfold online and outside of the Wells Fargo Arena among the Bernie or Bust people. What are you seeing?
What I was seeing on Twitter and sort of hearing around the convention was people saying, you know, these Sanders supporters, these Bernie or Bust people, they probably don't have undocumented relatives. And so they're not afraid of Donald Trump becoming president and deporting their families, right? But I spoke to this woman, Carmen Holbert. She's a Peruvian American from New York. She's a Bernie Sanders delegate. And she did tell me after the convention last night that she's not going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
And why not?
Because she believes in Bernie Sanders' political revolution. And she doesn't think that undocumented people in the States have anything more to fear from Donald Trump than they do from Barack Obama, who's been called the deporter in chief and has deported millions of people during his terms in office. Basically, her take particularly was that when it comes to deportations, Donald Trump would sort of just be as bad as Obama is.
Did you speak with any Hillary Clinton supporters about those feelings? And
yeah.
What do they say?
Yeah. So this morning I talked to Helen Gim. She is Philadelphia's first Asian American councilwoman. She's the daughter of a Korean immigrant. And she actually got really worked up when I told her what Carmen Holbert from New York had told me. She said she doesn't have time for Bernie supporters who are just angry that their candidate didn't get elected. That's Helen's take. And actually, these people that bring up Obama's deportation record, you know, call him the deporter in chief, something that they don't really talk about is the fact that Obama had the executive action that has allowed lots of undocumented kids to go to school, to go to college, to stay in the U.S. legally. Mm. It's a thing that gets renewed every 2 years. And
DACA.
I think a lot – it's DACA, right?
Right.
And I think a lot of people who either have family members on DACA or DAPA, which is the version sort of for parents, I think a lot of people are worried that a Donald Trump presidency would mean the end of this executive action, and not just that a Donald Trump presidency would mean more deportation. So there's a little bit of a nuance there that you kind of have to take into consideration.
Maria, quick look ahead to tonight. What will you be expecting or listening out for?
Well, I've been fascinated by the way women have been portrayed and talked about throughout this election, especially at the convention. So you might be hearing from me later this week about that.
The world's Maria Muriel at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Thanks again, Maria.
Thank you.
At both conventions, we've been asking people what it means to be an American. We're posting their answers on our Instagram. To see them, just look for The World. Now let's zero in on one specific comment from last night. This was actress Eva Longoria.
Now, I'm ninth generation American. My family never crossed a border. The border crossed us.
Longoria is referring to families along the border whose time there goes so far back that as the border changed through history, some of them ended up in the U.S., others found themselves on the Mexican side. Carlos Velez Ibanez teaches at the School of Transborder Studies at Arizona State University, and his was one of those families separated by the border. So what was his reaction to Longoria's comment?
A lot of reactions, both emotional and psychological. My father's great uncle saw the last Mexican flag come down in Tucson, Arizona in 1853.
Wow.
And what has to be understood, of course, is that the border is only two grandmothers old, but the first implementation of the first border was in 1848, and the second one in 1853 with the Gadsden Purchase. So the border is a very recent phenomenon. As well as prior to the creation of the border, people were going back and forth south to north and north to south for over 1,200 years. So that you have, for example, the same linguistic family, which is called Uto-Aztecan, being shared by the Hopis up in northern Arizona with Mesoamerican Aztecs. So it's from the same family of languages. So you have this enormously linguistic, cultural, as well as economic relationship between north and south and south and north. You have trade and exchange going on even before the arrival of the Europeans.
Right. So the border that we know today, what happened when that border was finally settled?
Once the border was established, and then you had Mexicans on the northern side of the border who remained and Mexicans who went south of the border. But here is what is most imperative for people to understand. The border did not divide the kinship systems and the social relationships between people who lived on one side or the other. This was the same population speaking Spanish and having English imposed upon them. So what you have here is you have the creation then, because of the reality of everyday life and of everyday commerce and of everyday economy in this entire border region, bilingualism became a very important part of the normal kind of establishment of communication in the border region. So when Longoria talks about we didn't cross the border crossed us, she's absolutely correct. We also didn't let the border cross us because we maintained relationships. So let me give you a personal example. About half of my cousins who lived on the Sonoran side of the border graduated from the University of Arizona in the 1950s and the 1960s, especially in agriculture, in order to introduce those agricultural techniques on the Sonoran side, as well as during the summers. I used to go from Tucson, Arizona to Magdalena, Sonora to attend primary school during the summers when I was on vacation in order to make sure that, because my parents insisted on my having high level of linguistic skills in Spanish as well. Mm. But that's normative for us.
Well, as this country discusses immigration reform, it sounds like you're pretty happy that Eva Longoria provided this little history note last night.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because she brings to bear two things. One, how facile some of these politicians are in regard to, in fact, addressing this whole aspect of immigration. See, for us, it's not immigration. For us, it's just migration. Why? Well, because, again, immigration really only was established two grandmothers old ago for most of us. So it's migration for us. Migration has been a very normative part of this entire region for thousands of years, if not and certainly hundreds of years.
Carlos Velez Ibanez teaches at the School of Transborder Studies at Arizona State University. Thank you for speaking with us today, Carlos.
You're very welcome.
Let's focus on another line in another speech from last night. Here's Bernie Sanders rattling off a few provisions he championed for the Democratic Party platform.
It also calls for strong opposition to job-killing trade agreements like the TPP.
As Sanders spoke, many in the audience were holding signs with the letters TPP X'd out. So for a reminder of what the TPP is all about and why the crowd was so riled up about it, Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
Let's start with the basics. TPP is shorthand for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The agreement would create a trade zone with lower tariffs, or taxes, for 12 Pacific member nations. The U.S., Japan, Malaysia, Vietnam, Singapore, Brunei, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Mexico, Chile, and Peru. And not China. The 12 countries account for 40% of the global economy. Opponents say a new trading bloc would allow American firms to more easily move overseas to take advantage of cheap foreign labor, or keep jobs here in the U.S., but with lower wages. President Obama doesn't see things that way.
With this Trans-Pacific Partnership, we are writing the rules for the global economy. America is leading in the 21st century. Our workers will be the ones who get ahead. Our businesses will get a fair deal.
Obama adds that not passing the TPP gives China the advantage writing the rules of 21st century trade. China is working on its own trade deal with 15 nations. The president wants Congress to ratify the TPP before he leaves office. Here's part of the reason, Donald Trump.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is another disaster, done and pushed by special interests who want to rape our country.
Then there's Hillary Clinton. Her stance is less cut and dry. As Secretary of State, Clinton called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, quote, the gold standard in trade agreements. But now she says the TPP doesn't meet her high standard for creating good American jobs. Economist Derek Scissors with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington says Clinton has a problem.
Saying it was the gold standard really puts her into a corner because nothing really changed. She has never come up with a reason, well, it was the gold standard, and then this happened.
Still, Shihoko Goto with the Wilson Center in Washington says Clinton can take control of the narrative by talking about the positives that come with more free trade and the TPP.
One of the problems that the pro-trade lobby has had is to kind of tell the good stories. And the good stories is that trade actually brings a lot of jobs into the United States as well.
For example, foreign multinationals would certainly be more attracted to setting up shops in the U.S., thereby providing jobs for Americans.
And you already see that with companies like the Japanese car makers, like Toyota, Honda, Nissan. They all have big bases in places like Ohio and in Tennessee. And this will actually increase with TPP because the United States and Japan do not have a bilateral free trade agreement.
On the other hand, the TPP could cost some American jobs. For example, American textile workers would likely lose more work to Vietnam. But there are other benefits. New markets would open up to American exporters. There would be winners and losers, but overall, Goto thinks the TPP would benefit the U.S. economy. Derek Scissors isn't as convinced of its value. He thinks the TPP could have been even more comprehensive, but he adds the deal wouldn't be a job killer.
So when people like Donald Trump, like Bernie Sanders, are telling you the TPP is a disaster, that's not what the evidence says.
Beyond the economic case for the TPP, there's the political one. Shihoko Goto says the TPP would strengthen ties among Asian-Pacific nations.
One of the TPP countries is Vietnam. Vietnam, of course, is a communist country, and yet communist Vietnam is eagerly embracing the TPP standards. Now, I think that's a good thing.
Hillary Clinton would like a more stable Asia to be part of her legacy as Secretary of State. As president, she could help make that happen, but she'd have to go against her current stance opposing the TPP, and, well, we'll see what happens. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
You're tuned to The World. Terrorism, some say, is more about the perception of fear and not actual threats. Take the nearly one dozen hit lists that ISIS has created and posted online. Security experts don't believe the list will lead to actual attacks. But face it, if your name is on one of those lists, it's scary. A recent one included the names of 3,600 New Yorkers. Another list, more than 100 government workers right here in Massachusetts. Boston Globe reporter Jan Ransom has been looking into the story.
These lists aren't really sophisticated. They're sort of open source lists that anyone can really pull from online. The reason why they're targeted is because they're average American citizens. Initially, the ISIS affiliate group would publish lists of like military personnel, political officials who have been vocal in the fight against terrorism. But what you're seeing now is this push to target, you know, average Joes to sort of stoke fear among people, people like you and I.
I know you've spoken with some of the state employees. How are they feeling about being on an ISIS hit list?
You know, people are taking it in different ways. One woman that I spoke to, she was completely terrified to learn that she had been named. She didn't know how to, you know, react. She didn't know if she should change her routine, if she would somehow, you know, cause any problems for people at her job. And she didn't know how to talk to her family about it. And so it was really hard for her to deal with it. She's still having problems, you know, working through it and trying to figure out, you know, what her next step should be. Other people, a chief fiscal officer that I spoke to, he notified his local police department, who promised to like send an extra car around past his area where he lives. But he himself, he said he's not too concerned. He feels like since, you know, it's a list of, you know, relatively rank and file employees, that it isn't something that they should be concerned about. And I think, you know, assurances from the Baker administration, that has helped a lot as well.
Governor Charlie Baker.
To calm everyone. Yes, Governor Charlie Baker, yes.
Overall, though, how is the state reacting to these threats, the state of Massachusetts?
So they reacted really quickly. The list came down July 16th. That's a Saturday. Department of Homeland Security notified state and local law enforcement officials right away. And that Monday, the Baker administration sent out an email just, you know, letting department heads know, you know, who was on the list and that they had nothing to fear. It was not deemed to be a credible threat. After all, this is the latest in a series of similar hit lists that have been issued in other places such as Chicago, New York, Rhode Island. And to their knowledge, no one has ever been killed from these lists. Again, extremism experts say this is just, you know, scare tactics. Mm.
Did any of the people on the list that you spoke with, have they changed their routines?
So the woman who I spoke to, you know, who was pretty terrified to hear about it, she, you know, so she's more aware now. And I think that goes for the other folks that I interviewed as well. Like, they're just being more aware. You know, if they have a Facebook account, they're making it private. So simple, small safety measures like that.
You know, it is an anxiety-provoking time we live in. The headlines are just filled with attacks. Right. Did you get a sense, speaking with these Massachusetts government officials, of just kind of the frayed nerves right now?
They know people are scared, right? I mean, it's the times that we live in, and you just don't know what's going to happen. Because of that, they are being, you know, mindful and considerate that, you know, some people really are afraid, and, you know, rightfully so.
And the kind of decision whether to tell their families, and specifically their children, I mean, how wrenching a decision is that? Like, do I tell my kids that I'm on this hit list?
For some of the people that I spoke to, they didn't. You know, this one guy, he had a 13 and 17 year old, and, you know, they see day in and day out what's happening, you know, across the country, and they don't want to have their children worrying about them, particularly in the case in which, you know, they have been told it's not a credible threat. So this guy, his thinking was, you know, why cause my children, you know, further worry and upset them and have them, you know, thinking the worst. So, yeah, it's a difficult decision. It was difficult for some people to even tell their spouses. That same guy, you know, he said his wife was pretty upset, but she kind of, you know, followed his lead and they're okay with it. They're moving on.
Boston Globe reporter Jan Ransom, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Like taking coals to Newcastle, an expression that suggests an act of futility, as in why in the world would you take coals to a place, Newcastle, UK, whose lifeblood was that fossil fuel, which makes the decision to divest from fossil fuels by Newcastle University all that more remarkable. Phil Taylor directs the Institute of Sustainability at Newcastle. So when we think Newcastle, we think coal. Remind us why, Professor Taylor.
Well, it's a great heritage that Newcastle-upon-Tyne has in its contribution to economic and industrial development through coal mining in this region, employed a very great many people and provided a lot of prosperity and development. But times have changed, and there's a really very pressing need to decarbonize our energy systems if we're going to avoid catastrophic climate change.
So how big a deal is this decision by one university, Newcastle University?
The portfolio that's being divested by Newcastle University is relatively small on a global scale, but it's a big statement, and it's one that a number of other universities are already following and going along with, and many other organizations are either considering this or moving in the same direction. So although in isolation this might not change the world, we hope it's part of a progressive movement that will accelerate the movement to a new lower carbon economy.
So how's this decision playing in the city of Newcastle-on-Tyne? Do people understand what's going on?
People understand it. And also the Newcastle City Council have just signed an agreement where they, as a city, have signed up to become zero carbon by 2050 as a city. So what the university's doing is perfectly in tune with what the city's aspirations are as well. What we're trying to do is be proud of our heritage, but also realize that we've got to move on. We can't be nostalgic and live in the past and then not have prosperity, job opportunities for the people of Newcastle. So, you know, we're thinking of things like data mining rather than coal mining now, and trying to generate a new set of skills and jobs in the region and in the city. The students, I think, are reasonably happy as well because we listened. I think it was very important that a lot of the money that the university has comes from those students. And as a younger generation, it's those people who are going to inherit the climate that we may create by continuing to burn fossil fuels.
So you probably know that we're in a pretty big political fight here in the U.S. over the future of the coal industry. There in the U.K., coal more or less died out a generation ago. What are the lessons from the experience in the U.K. for us here in the U.S. right now?
I think one big lesson is that it can be done in a very bruising, abrupt way that damages communities and families for generations. And we still see a lot of social costs from the way that the coal mining industry was shut down in the UK. We still see families who have lots of unemployment that has passed on through generations that might have been traditionally involved in the mining industry. So I think it needs to be planned. It needs to be carried out carefully with great consultation. And also you need to start to look at providing new skills, new opportunities for training and skills development in the people who are employed in that sector so that it can move into other jobs that are related to growing sectors of the market, like lower carbon sectors or the digital sector.
Phil Taylor directs the Institute of Sustainability at Newcastle University in the UK, which recently decided to divest its holdings in the fossil fuel industry. Really appreciate your explaining this to us. Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the BBC's Jenny Murray remembers what it was like when Margaret Thatcher became Britain's first female prime minister back in the late 70s.
In those days, to call yourself a feminist, it was the F word. It was not acceptable.
That story is coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Political unity, it proved elusive for Republicans last week, and now it seems to be the Democrats' turn to find some. The first day of the DNC saw some potent exchanges between delegates in the crowd and speakers on stage. Michelle Obama's time in the spotlight was one of the few moments in which Democrats seemed to come together. Leo Hornack is usually in our London office at the BBC, but we sent him to both conventions for an outsider's perspective on our American political process. And last night in Philly, he says, was quite the show.
Well, being there on the floor, Marco, the thing that really struck me was these moments where the crowd kind of grabbed the script and took control. And I've watched conventions and conferences on TV, but it's when you're there, when you hear people actually jeering the stage, and then it's not just one person jeering or shouting, "We trusted you." It's suddenly a big section, and the stage and the person on the stage is forced to move off the teleprompter and actually address what's happening to them.
I mean, don't you see that kind of unscripted, spontaneous thing in Parliament in London? I mean, it's rowdy. There's catcalling. It's not the same?
Yeah, we do have that, but it is quite scripted. And if I can make a comparison, those are elite politicians trading trading quips with each other, trading zingers. So it's much more like the equivalent in the US is Elizabeth Warren and Donald Trump going head to head on Twitter. And the moment that, it, for me, it really kind of turned was Al Franken and Sarah Silverman were making some lighthearted banter, and it was supposed to be fun. And Sarah Silverman said, you know, I felt the burn, but I got a cream and I got it treated.
I got a cream for that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That didn't go down well, Marco.
Really?
That wasn't what they wanted
to hear. That was actually
to
hard to tell on TV. Was it a laugh moment, or was she getting jeered for that?
Some of the audience, there were chuckles, but there was a big part of the audience, way too soon, way too soon. And they started booing and jeering. And what was really interesting was probably Sarah Silverman turned around and said,
to the Bernie or bust people, you're being ridiculous.
What was interesting to me about that was she was also probably the only person who has experience of being heckled as a stand-up comedian who could actually do that and go off the teleprompter and actually engage in a proper dialogue with the crowd. And that was the moment where you suddenly felt like the crowd had become an individual that was having a conversation with the stage. That is something I haven't experienced, certainly in British politics, very often. And I don't think it has happened very much in American politics either.
For somebody like you, Leo, coming from the scripted moments in Parliament, what's it like seeing all that? You know, people down in the audience saying, we trusted you, Elizabeth Warren.
Well, I mean, as I said, it's exciting because you have that moment of something is being improvised. I think it takes you back in a way, for me at least, it takes you back to the kind of origins of democracy, really. I mean, it takes you back to the days before TV, before Twitter, when for American politicians and British politicians, you go even further back, if you like, where it was about someone standing on a stage in front of a crowd and trying to win that crowd over with their words, and the crowd using their own words to throwing their own words back. There's one moment that it did remind me of from UK politics, which was quite a small but significant turning point. In the early Blair years, he could do no wrong.
Tony
he
Blair, was Prime Minister Tony Blair.
Yeah, with Tony Blair. In the early Tony Blair era in Britain, he could do no wrong. He'd won a huge success in his election. It felt like he couldn't put a step wrong. And there was just one moment where he addressed the Women's Institute, a very old-fashioned, small-C conservative women's group. And he started just reeling off what he thought were his great successes. Crowd wasn't with him. And increasingly, this set of very respectable, middle-aged, small-town women started to turn on him. It had never happened to Tony Blair before. They started slow-hand clapping him, jeering. And I just remember the film of that and his face kind of like, whoa, this can happen to me too. Now, I don't know if there was an equivalent last night, but I don't think that someone like maybe Elizabeth Warren is used to having her supporters shout, we trusted you, at her. I don't know if it's the same moment exactly, but there was that same moment of like, I'm not used to having these people say they're not with me when I make a speech. It's a moment that every politician, I think, dreads.
So all comparisons aside, Leo, you just sound really pumped having kind of witnessed democracy in action in the United States. Do you wish you could see more of this kind of hard on your sleeve back in the UK, these unscripted bits where the people stare down the elected officials?
Well, it's exhilarating. I think as a reporter, it's exhilarating, of course, when you see something that you're there when history's being made in a way. But at the same time, these kind of spontaneous political moments come out of deep unhappiness with the political situation.
Our man in London, Leo Hornack, who is currently in Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention. Thanks a lot, Leo.
Thanks very much, Marco.
So a historic night for Hillary Rodham Clinton, the first woman nominated for the U.S. presidency by a major party. My BBC colleague Jenny Murray is the longtime host of Woman's Hour, the BBC's signature program on women's affairs for listeners in the U.K. I wanted to get her thoughts on Clinton's nomination. She took me back to the late 1970s when Margaret Thatcher became Britain's first female prime minister.
In those days, it seems ridiculous now when the internet is full of young women calling themselves feminists quite happily. But in those days, to call yourself a feminist, it was the F word, you know, it was not acceptable. And had she described herself as a feminist, which I have to say she very clearly said to me often, I'm not a feminist and I don't like strident women. I've always said she didn't have very much self-knowledge because she was probably one of the most strident women I've ever come across in my life. But she had to be very careful not to overstep the feminist mark. What was disappointing about her was that she never brought any other women up behind her. And whenever I asked her about the younger women who would have made perfectly good cabinet ministers, far better actually than some of the handsome young men that she surrounded herself with, she always said, oh no dear, they're not ready yet. But they were ready. She absolutely resisted the idea of bringing up other women. And I mean, one of the favourite quotes I have about her was made by a journalist here, Beatrix Campbell, who described Thatcher in this way. She said, femininity is what she wears and masculinity is what she admires.
So what do you think would happen today if a woman leader were to kind of ignore women the way Margaret Thatcher did?
I now think things have changed a great deal. And it was very interesting that one of the things that Theresa May, our new Prime Minister, said in her first speech was that she had concerns about unequal pay.
You know, the way Michelle Obama framed the choice of president last night in her speech was pretty interesting. She focused not on a personality per se, but how any candidate would affect the lives of her children, of children all over the country, especially girls. And let's listen to this, because indirectly she talks about how female candidates are viewed with different standards.
There were plenty of moments when Hillary could have decided that this work was too hard, that the price of public service was too high, that she was tired of being picked apart for how she looks or how she talks or even how she laughs.
So, Jenny Murray, do you think a President Hillary Clinton offers some hope to women and their daughters in the way that maybe Margaret Thatcher didn't? Should single mothers in America be hopeful?
I interviewed Hillary Clinton 2 years ago, and I've been in this business for a very long time, since 1973, and of all the people I have interviewed in my entire career, she is the one who impressed me more than any other, man or woman.
Why is that?
Because she was intelligent. She had experience. You know, we talked about the way she dealt with some of the really difficult issues that she faced when she was traveling the country as Secretary of State. I remembered hearing her speak in Beijing in the late 90s at the UN Women's Conference when she was the person who first said, you know, at a time again when it wasn't fashionable to show your feminist credentials, she was the one who said women's rights are human rights. And all of this stuff she was prepared to talk about openly and warmly. She was warm about Monica Lewinsky when I asked her about her, because Lewinsky had been in London not very long before she came. She was generous about her. And the one thing she said about, I asked her about Bill and how she dealt with this man's wicked behaviour. And one of the things she said was that they had met as students and they had started a conversation. And that after all these years of marriage and a child, they were still having a conversation. And to me, she summed up what a marriage is really all about. It's not about sexual shenanigans. It's about a friendship. And she clearly has a close friendship with that man and has forgiven him all the nonsense that he put her through. And for that, I admired her enormously.
Well, it was interesting when Michelle Obama was speaking last night and referring to Hillary Clinton that she's never quit anything in her life. I think people who are listening carefully knew exactly what she was talking about.
Well, she understands international politics, but she also understands people and what people need.
Jenny Murray, the longtime presenter of BBC Radio 4's Woman's Hour. Jenny, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Let's catch up on what's been going on in Ukraine. This was 2.5 years ago on CBS News.
We begin there. The ousted president of Ukraine is now a fugitive on the run. Reports say Viktor Yanukovych was last seen in Crimea.
February 2014, pro-Russian President Viktor Yanukovych was stripped of his presidency. He fled the country, leaving behind a lavish secret estate. Many Ukrainians hoped it would one day become a museum of corruption, kind of a reminder of what they wanted to change in their country. Reporter Julia Barton recently visited the old Yanukovych Palace and found that it's become something quite different.
Before Yanukovych left in a hurry, very few Ukrainians had ever seen what their president had built on a former nature preserve outside Kiev. It's called Mezhehirya. Alexander Tichensky was among about 30 journalists who stormed the gates at Mezhehirya the morning after Yanukovych fled. Local officials tried to stop them, he says.
And we start to run like a cockroaches different ways, and they can't catch us. And then later, all of us meet near the main palace.
The journalists weren't prepared for the opulence they glimpsed through the windows. Even today, going on a tour, it's a little hard to fathom.
Oh my God. Whoa. This is the grand staircase. He's just lit the chandelier, which is two stories tall.
Documents found on the premises showed that Yanukovych spent at least $30 million on his estate, which includes a private zoo and a restaurant on a boat. Now this place is a popular summer destination. A sign at the entrance says tours are only conducted in Ukrainian, but today our guide, Petro Olenik, has agreed to accommodate some Russian-speaking visitors. Olenik has basically been living here since Mezhehirya fell into the hands of one faction of right-wing nationalist protesters after Yanukovych fled. Olenik has a red satin cloth draped around his shoulders, embroidered with a gold trident, the symbol of Ukraine. There's also a red and black flag flying over Mezhehirya. It's the battle flag of a controversial Ukrainian paramilitary group from World War II. But as our guide, Olenik doesn't want to talk about the past. Mainly, he wants to talk about the failings of Ukraine's current president, Petro Poroshenko.
Poroshenko Krim продал Путину.
Poroshenko sold Crimea to Putin and handed him part of the East so he could loot and destroy it, Olenik says at the start of our tour, which pretty much turns into an hour-long harangue against Ukraine's current leaders.
Last time he was more explaining about the things, but now he's talking more about politics.
That's Tichensky again. He last took Olenik's tour about a year ago. We're standing in front of a stuffed lion in a hallway between the private bowling alley and a massive spa complex. Everything is spotless and well taken care of. Over in the main hall, the piano is still in tune, and visitors are eager to play it. Legally, Olenik and his paramilitary companions are just squatters here. The buildings at Mezhehirya still belong to the holding company that Yanukovych set up when he built and privatized this place. Ukraine's parliament has failed to agree on legislation that would put Mezhehirya fully under state control, so it remains in a murky gray zone. It's not clear exactly who runs it or how they pay for upkeep of the massive property. Petr Olenik says he'd like to see Mezhehirya nationalized, but he also sees the current state of affairs as a symbolic victory. It's an example of how people have self-organized, with no single leader or boss, he says. People can live like this in this country. We don't need a government. And with that, our tour is over. By the way, the piano here, it's a limited edition replica of the white piano John Lennon gave Yoko Ono. Steinway made only 100 of them, worth about $90,000 apiece. After all we've seen here, its presence is not even a surprise. For The World, Julia Barton, Mezhehirya, Ukraine.
Julia's story was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. And you can see that white Steinway, this white Steinway, along with other photos from inside Yanukovych's old residence at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Sometimes it seems like we analyze, maybe overanalyze, each little twist and turn in the U.S. presidential election. But we are not alone. Chude Jidonwo is a media entrepreneur and lawyer in Lagos, Nigeria. He and his friends have been on Twitter all day today discussing one thing, Michelle Obama's speech.
Yeah, everybody's unanimous. It's Michelle Obama for POTUS.
Straight there. Nobody else. No Hillary, no Bernie, no Trump. It's Michelle Obama.
No. Most of the digital influencers on Twitter were focused on her speech, videos of her speech, photos from her speech, live tweets from her speech. She was undoubtedly the standout.
What specifically did your friends find most appealing about Michelle Obama's speech?
There's a term in Nigeria called subliminals. I don't know if it's the same in the US. So people like the fact that she was throwing subs at Trump without needing to call his name. That was remarkable. I mean, first and foremost, the Obamas are cool in Nigeria. A lot of people like the Obamas. You know, it's easy to like them. Of course, we're talking about the digitally connected set. So maybe that doesn't reflect the generality of the populace. But as far as conversations that you can track on Twitter, on Facebook, on the blogs, on Instagram, yes, Nigerians would very much like a third term of Barack Obama.
It's incredible, though, the way you're talking about it. It feels like you are right here in the United States following all this. And
I'm right there in the United States. I've forwarded, and I'm not joking, 13 links in the past 4 hours to a friend of mine whom I am monitoring the elections with. We are here saddened at those who are booing speakers at the Democratic National Convention. It's almost as if it were our election. I went to see my nephews and nieces on Sunday, and they were upset with me because I'm a supporter of Hillary Clinton, because they figure that anybody below 35 should connect with the Bernie Sanders campaign. And my niece is 15. So, and she's having almost exactly the same debate that women in America are having, because her mother, who is almost 50, is obviously a Hillary Clinton supporter, and her daughter doesn't care for that whole history, so to speak. So yes, sometimes it can feel like I am a delegate at the DNC.
Can you just explain to us why there is such an attraction, especially now, for Nigerians to what they see in U.S. politics?
I remember in 2008 being attacked on Facebook because even then I was a Hillary supporter, and people couldn't understand why a young Black African could be supporting Hillary Clinton against the man who was about to be America's president. I lost friends, and I'm not exaggerating. I lost friends. People, there were invectives being transferred. Nigerians have calcified opinions about Sarah Palin, you know.
But why? I still don't understand why Nigeria. I mean, the debate is so lively in Nigeria. You'd think Nigerians were voting in their own election. Why is that?
American elections are almost like a movie. There's always a bad guy and a good guy. So there's a very easy, compelling narrative to kind of plug into. CNN is hugely popular. There are parts of the country where MSNBC is popular. There are parts of the country where, I mean, Fox News is hugely popular, even if people don't watch Fox News. Now, Donald Trump, who was already hugely popular in Nigeria because of his books, The Art of the Deal, Why We Want You to Be Rich, Ben Carson, whose autobiography has been hugely popular. I read Gifted Hands, 8 years ago. So we have colorful characters that resonate with Nigerians of all stripes. And of course, it's no surprise that we're glued to these elections.
Chude Jidonwo is a Nigerian media entrepreneur and lawyer in Lagos. Chude, thanks for your time.
Thanks. Always a pleasure to talk about America's elections.
Finally today, a story about San Jose. Three stories, in fact, about three different San Joses. I'm talking about cities by that name in California, Costa Rica, and Trinidad. One musician's latest project connects all three of them. His name is Etienne Charles, a jazz trumpeter from Trinidad. His just released album is called San Jose Suite. Charles starts our tour in Costa Rica.
The song that we're listening to now is Baruca, which is a song about the Baruca people of Costa Rica. They are one of 8 indigenous tribes left in Costa Rica, and they still manufacture their own textiles, they produce all of their own food, and they celebrate a really interesting festival called the Juego de los Diablitos. In the Juego de los Diablitos, they wear these ornate wooden, hand-carved, hand-painted masks. Now, these masks symbolize Diablos, and they clash with each other, and they also clash with a masked bull. It's a costume that is made to look like a bull, and the bull symbolizes the Spanish. And the whole dance, the whole game, as I call it, is used to replicate their fighting the Spanish when the Spanish were in their conquest in Costa Rica. So that was Costa Rica, and now we will continue to my homeland of Trinidad. We're going to play a piece for you called Revolt. And Revolt is specifically in dedication to an African mutiny that happened in Trinidad after the abolition of slavery. And this song employs the African rhythms, the depth, and the blues to create the picture of a revolt. So now we are in San Jose, California, and the former nickname for San Jose, California was Speed City, specifically in reference to the track team at San Jose State University in the 1960s. This song is a tribute to their movement to desegregate campus in San Jose. The song employs the music of funk, specifically because at the time, funk was in an advent similar to the civil rights movement. You've been listening to selections from my San Jose Suite album. I do hope that you enjoyed it.
Trinidad's own 810 Charles there on horn, ending our program today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.